I'd like to welcome everyone here this morning. Thank you for coming out. That clock is fast, so I just wanted to make sure. I know I've been going by that one, and it is about 2 minutes. So whoever's preaching and you're looking back, give them about a three-minute window on time if you're looking back there. Thank you again for being out. We have a beautiful Sunday morning. Excited to be with you. We will finish Esther this week. We're going to try to get through half of chapter 9, and then we'll do the rest of 9 and 10 on Wednesday in a short review. Stephen, if you want to start reading, Stephen Ogden will start the book of Ruth next Sunday. So we'll be starting the book of Ruth next Sunday, and he will take us through the book of Ruth. So go ahead and feel free to read that. Great book. I'm looking forward to that class. Before we get started, I've asked our brother Brad to lead us in prayer, so if we can get him a mic.
Let's pray together. Dear God, our Father in heaven, we thank you for this day that you've given us. We thank you for the allowing us to be able to wake up this morning and to experience the creation that you've created for us. We thank you for allowing us to be together on this Lord's Day. Allowing us to be together with each other, allowing us to come to this place and to be involved in a Bible class to study more about your word. We'd ask you to be with Gerald this morning as he directs our minds. Help him to apply the things that he has studied. Help him to open those to us and help us to be good recipients of the things that he's prepared for us this morning. Dear God, be with each one that's represented in this room. Whatever struggles or trials that they are going through at this time, we'd ask that your big hand be upon them and help them in those things. Help us as Christians to help one another in the best ways that we can. We'll look to you for that guidance, and we'll do our best to always make right decisions. We realize that we fail in those so many times, and we'll continue to look to your word and to appreciate it. We'd ask you to help us to understand the truths that we read and that we study about and to apply those things in our lives as they're most needed. Thank you for sending your son Jesus to die for us, and thank you for allowing that sacrifice to forgive our sins. Help us to be better Christians and better lights in the world, and help us to appreciate your word more each day as we go to it for our guidance. Thank you for all that you do. Be with all who are in this building, especially the children that are in the back, as their young minds are open and learning from your word. Be with those teachers and give them strength to be able to open those things unto them and them to learn this morning. Thank you so much for all that you do for us. And in heaven, we'd ask you to save us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Brad. You know, you go through a book like Esther, and I know there are all different kinds of themes you could draw out. There's academic themes, there's different people who've written books and have gotten all kinds of different themes and ideas and concepts and different things you can draw. But I think the one thing to me that, as we finish up this, that seems to be the main theme in my mind, and I have the right to say what my main theme in my mind is that what seems impossible is possible. What seems impossible is possible. And I think as we live our lives, we need to remember that. With God, all things are possible. We have an orphan girl, which in this day and age would admit she was worthless. Not only was she an orphan girl, she was an orphan girl who was a Jew who were in captivity in a land. So we're talking an orphan girl, a Jew in a captivity of a land. It would have been no way she could have ever been queen of anything. And yet, she rises to be queen and winds up helping save her people. You have Mordecai here who once again, is with these group of Jews who were in captivity, who rises to be very powerful in the nation due to the events that happened. And if anybody would have looked at this beforehand, they would have said, this is impossible. Matter of fact, they would have said this is impossible multiple times of the events that took place, from the edict that came down, killing everyone, to him, you know, helping save the king. All the events that took place would have seemed impossible until they actually happened. And I think that's important as Christians and as we live our lives, to have an attitude of possible. One of the things that you'll learn about me if you really get to know me is I truly believe anything is possible. I look at every obstacle in life, and I do what I call the cannonball approach. Anybody know what the cannonball approach is? Well, that's where you just run off and jump in the pool and you ball up and you have no idea whether you can swim. You don't know how deep it is. You don't know anything. You just jump in, and guess what? You got two options at that point, right? It's either sink and drown or swim. And I love that because, you know, in life there's so many things that can be a fear. Getting up here and teaching a class or doing a sermon or doing anything. Funny story about impossible to possible about preaching. I took a preacher training job. Now, you would think in order to take a preacher training job, you'd have done at least a couple things, right? Right? You'd at least have preached before, right? Taught a class, maybe done some invitations. I showed up to the job that the night that I took the preacher training job. It was my first day on the job. It was a Wednesday night. Silver Street up in Indiana. Preacher comes up to me, says, "You want to do the invitation tonight?" I said, "No, I don't. I came up here for you to teach me how to do that." And he goes, "You've never done?" I was like, "I have never done an invitation before, nor have I ever preached." And he was so shocked. I guess he didn't ask me that question in the interview. And I looked at him and I said, "That was the whole point of me coming here. You were going to teach me how to do that, right?" I didn't do the invitation that night. Matter of fact, I didn't do a lot for about a month. And the point I'm making by that is that you just got to jump in. And so whatever obstacles that you have in your life, think about Esther. Think about Mordecai. Think about where they started. And think about with God, all things are possible. And that with God, you can accomplish anything. And if God is on your side, you win. Period. You don't have to go, "I think I'm going to win. I hope I'm going to win." You win. You don't have to worry. And I think that's so amazing here when we look at Esther and we see chapter 9 and 10, which will be showing, you know, where they're at and how things had turned, and turned in a way that nobody would have ever believed. And so we get here into Esther chapter 9. Jason, is a clicker. Do I need to turn it on? Okay, here we go. Esther chapter 9, verse 1 and 2 here. It says, "Now in the 12th month, that is the month of Adar." Now, if you've been in this class long enough now, you know that's December, right? I say December. It's the last month of the year. So if you learn 2 months, Adar is one that you should walk out of here and you should know. And on the 13th day, when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, and on that day when the enemy of these Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, it was turned into the contrary, so that the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities throughout all the province of the king Ahasuerus and laid hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand before them, for the dread of them had fallen on all the people. And so we fast forward now. So the first few chapters of the book, we're talking about what's going to happen a year from now. Now we're finally at that day. We're a year into this story here, and this is the day when everything was supposed to happen. But we see here that the Jews were given hope. They were given the authority to fight back. The text doesn't tell us exactly what that meant, whether it meant they allowed them to get their armies together and mobilize, whether it meant that they were able to get weapons, or whether it means that Mordecai provided weapons or armor or whatever. We don't really know because the text doesn't provide us that. But whatever the case was, it allowed them to fight back. And here that they were there, and it says the Jews hoped to gain mastery over them. And here they by that it says that those who hated them. And it's interesting, the text is going to use that word "hated" again. I know we read this story and we think that Haman is the only one that hates Mordecai, therefore he wants to kill all the Jews. It's not the case. Haman's dead. And you would assume that this would have ended with that, right? But there were those who hated the Jews in these 127 provinces. And they wanted them destroyed by whatever means. Why they hated them, I have some ideas here in a minute, but they hated them. And they wanted them so bad that they wanted them killed. So the rage that Haman had, he may have had that his whole life. And maybe he took it as an opportunity here because of his past history. And knowing Mordecai, maybe that was a chance to just, I got an excuse now. Let's just do it. Or I have an opportunity with the king to wipe him out. Whatever the case might be, there were those who hated them to the point that they wanted to kill them. How can you get to that point? I've never been to war, never even been in the military. Got really close to joining the Marines in August of 2001, but got pneumonia. Had to go to the hospital, got very sick, wound up not joining. And you know what events happened about 2 months after my pneumonia. I don't know if I was on the battlefield, if I were a soldier and I was fighting, that I would hate the people across. I'd be doing what I was commanded to do. I don't know that I would hate any people. I hear stories. Stephanie's grandfather was in World War II, and when he came back, he fought in the in the Asian side over in the Pacific, you know, with the the Japanese. And like when he came back home, he didn't want a Japanese car. He didn't want Japanese products. He didn't want Japanese anything. And maybe the war had changed him because Japanese soldiers had killed friends, or he had heard, or maybe the bombing of Pearl Harbor. But I know that he had a strong feeling toward that. But to hate people you don't know as a group, and to hate them so much that you'd want them dead, and they've never physically or done anything to you, I don't know. That just seems difficult for me. And if we do that, we need to question ourselves, because Christians wouldn't do that. We're not supposed to hate to begin with. Well, we are to hate. What are we to hate? There's only one thing, huh? Sin. That's the only thing we're commanded to hate. And then we're to hate anything that comes in front of Jesus. Jesus is supposed to be first in our lives. These people hated the Jews, and they wanted them dead. There are people throughout history who have hated different groups of people to the point they wanted them dead. And we see, if you look at the Jews in particular, but I want you to realize it's not just the Jewish nation. There have been many nations throughout history where individuals hated that group of people and wanted them dead. But you look at even Hitler and his situation. He hated the Jews. He hadn't met any of them. He didn't care. Kids, women, children, whatever. He hated the Jews and whatever it was they represented. And so these people hated them, and they wanted them dead, but the Jews had the right here to defend themselves. And so they assembled in their cities and throughout all the provinces to lay hands on those who sought their harm. Now notice, they weren't attacking random people in the nation. Who were they going to defend against and attack? Only those who wanted to kill them. This wasn't a war against King Ahasuerus and all the people in the province. It was a war against people who wanted them dead. And that's what they were doing. Those who hated them and wanted them dead. And so, and no one could stand before them. The dread of them had fallen on all the people. And so, could you imagine being here on this day? Being in Susa here, where it seems like that was a large part, but being all over, I mean, whose side are you on? Can you imagine how many times people got asked that question? You think Democrat and Republican is a big issue in our country? Can you imagine for a year in 127 provinces, whose side are you on? How that must have been in these different places in the cities, and how it must have divided different people, and how that was going to happen. Must have been very interesting, for sure. how that must have taken place. And it all stems from what? Why did all this happen? One word. Brad kind of said it. Hate. All of this, this whole divide. Did you say that? You didn't say that? She said it. Yeah, well, she helped you. That's good. Hate. Think about that. Think about what thousands of people are going to lose their lives here in a little while. All over hate. And we talked about how hate led Haman to the gallows and him being hung. But hate is going to lead to thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people that's going to be killed that don't know each other. They don't know anything about anybody. And they're going to wind up being dead. Hate will lead to so many things. And that's unfortunate. We have to make sure in our lives not to let hate grow in our hearts. We got to prevent that. We got to keep it out. We got to prevent it from being there. Because I see hate destroy families. I see hate destroy marriages. I see hate destroy friendship. I see hate destroy churches. I've seen hate destroy all different kinds of things. And people have hate. I know people, and this is being recorded, so I'm not going to give any examples for fear that they'll know who I'm talking about, so I don't want them to know. But I've seen hate where people for 35 years, family members who still don't talk to each other, I bet you they don't even know what they're mad about. They just hate. I can't remember what I did 10 years ago. I can't remember. And this hate must have been built up for years and years and years and years and years. They were ready to kill. They were battled and armed and ready to go. If they could have only figured out their differences, we wouldn't have had this. And thousands of people wouldn't have lost their lives.
And if we don't control our hate, it just spreads to our children. And they're the ones that don't know why they're hating. They're just hating because, well, mom and dad didn't like them. And so we're not going to like them either.
Yeah. Yep. We gotta work on that and set the example. We got one right here.
So are we saying then that the Jews also hated the people who sought to kill them? What was their motivation?
No, I think the Jews were defending themselves.
So that would be okay, no matter how fervent it was.
You're trying to trap me here in a question.
No. No, I'm because...
So I'm not going to answer that question. What do you think? So that's a good preacher thing. You need to throw it back on the person asking the question.
Well, I don't think that you can kill someone with murder in your heart.
Sure.
Or with hate in your heart.
I would agree with
without
that.
Without it, I'll say. I said it, I misspoke. Without some in your mind. Killing, as we all know, can be justified. War or protecting yourself or whatever. Murder's never justified. So, but I just think of my own self. I don't think if I love somebody, I could kill them, even if I was ordered to. I don't think it would be possible. I would have to have a reason and say, these people are going to murder me if I don't protect myself. So there's got to be some form of disdain, if you will, if you'd rather use that word, before I could do it, even in a war situation. You were saying before, I don't know either. I've never been tested, but I'd probably be the one in the back, you know, sitting there and crying. But this, you have to have some kind of apprehension in your heart in order to do the job.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of different ways we can go here. I think defending your family and defending what you have is I think it's something that's hard to sit here and say what you would do and what you wouldn't do. There's a great book that nobody in here would want to read and would put you to sleep, but it's one of my favorite books that I didn't even read. I actually listened to it on tape and then had somebody explain it to me because it's a very difficult book, but Plato's Republic. And one of the things that he talks about there is about military people and how when they go out, he actually said that they should never be put back in society because once you go out and you're in war and you see people killed and you wind up having to kill people and you do things, it messes with you and it messes with all kinds of stuff. Now, I'm not, and there's military people who are, and I'm not saying I agree with that necessarily, But I think when you're in a battle situation and people are coming at you, your mindset changes in a way that we don't know because we've never been there. But you have 50,000 people charging you with guns and cannons and everything, and here's all your comrades standing behind you, and you're standing there. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I would do. And I don't know. And I don't know. I don't know. I've tried to think about that. But the older I get, I learn to say that I don't know what I would do until I'm in that situation. But you know, it has to be a mindset of being scared and fearful. And we don't know. Text doesn't say that they went out and they. We'll read it just to make sure. But I don't believe it says that necessarily they attacked. I think these other people were attacking. I think they were merely defending here. But they had the right to do that. But we'll look at the text. I mean, and maybe they did go out and attack as well. We'll clarify that. But whatever the case is, this is a tough situation. This is a tough situation. And it's a hard situation. And where did it all stem from? Once again, it all came back to hate. If hate had not been there from the people who hated the Jews, and Haman hadn't had hate in his heart, then this situation wouldn't have taken place to begin with. And that would have been a very difficult one. The hatred for the Jews was bigger than Haman. We think that, Haman's the enemy here, and we do the whole lesson on Haman, but Haman's dead. Haman's dead, and the story continues. If it was just Haman, then this would be done. It would be over. But it's not. It's bigger. It's bigger than Haman. It's bigger than Esther. It's bigger than Mordecai, as we'll see later. I actually think it's bigger than a lot of things. Let's just back up. What did God tell the people before they crossed over? I read all of it this morning. I wanted to pick out one verse, and I couldn't. I was going to have us read like 50 verses. But before Moses died, and the people are crossing, about to cross over, and they give everything, what did God basically tell them? All right, I'll give you the Cliff Notes version, because that's the only thing I've ever read. And my company bought it, too, which is great. We own Cliff Notes. That's the most exciting line we've ever had, Cliff Notes. That's awesome. You know, anyway. He said, if you do what I tell you to do, you don't have to worry about anything. I will defeat every army. I will protect you. You will have food. You will have drink. You will have water. You will have whatever you need. I will be there for you if you follow my commands. Plain and simple. But if you do not follow my commands, what did he tell them? I'll be the worst enemy you've ever had. You will be defeated. You'll be destroyed. Everything will be against you. You will not. It will be the terrible thing ever. And so when they started out, they went in and they never really followed, right? They never really followed. They didn't really destroy all the nations. They let some people live. Some family members, which we find out, maybe some family members of Haman. And what do we know about Middle Eastern people even right now? What do we know about Middle Eastern people right now? Would you say they have short-term memories on events, or would you say they have long-term memories on events? Man, they're mad about things that happened 2,000 years ago. I don't know how they have the energy to be mad about all the things that they're mad about. But they remember this stuff. And I think some of this started because they didn't obey God and follow Him, but some of the nations and things that they did, nations remembered what the Jews did. And now that God wasn't with them, when they got conquered, what happened to them? Well, they got taken into captivity. Why are they even here to begin with? Why is Mordecai and Esther even in this situation to begin with? Why are we even reading this? They failed to obey God. Had they obeyed God, we would be studying something else in this class right now. I don't know what the name of the book would be, but it wouldn't be Esther. But because they did that, that led to this, which led to this, which led to this, which leads to people hating them for whatever reason, for whatever amount of time, which we'll see in a minute that I have my ideas, which John had brought out from the history of this relationship. But at the end of the day, if they'd obeyed God, they'd have been fine. And what can we learn from that? When we obey God and we follow God's will and His command and we do what God wants us to do, we're going to be fine too. It's when we don't. And that's when we decide things in our eyes, in our mind, in our heart, and we start doing things that we think are right, just like they did. Do we find ourselves in situations that we have no idea how we got there? And we have no idea how we're going to get out of it. And yet, if we had followed God from the beginning, we would not have been in that situation to begin with. And the reason they're in this situation, they even have to defend themselves, is because they didn't follow God's command from the very beginning when they crossed over.
And just like in the book of Esther, sometimes it's generations later that sin comes back to haunt them.
Yeah, that's the case here. That's what always cracks up about Middle Eastern people. Man, they have long-term memories. I mean, and they're remembering, and the hate could have stemmed from something like that.
I definitely agree that hate is a motivating factor here, but one other motivating factor is when Haman crafted the decree, he incentivized them to go after the Jews by allowing them to plunder their goods. There could be a greed motivation here too.
Yeah, and you're gonna, that's a good point, and we're gonna see what the Jews did here in a minute versus what Haman wanted to do, and it's a very interesting, contrasting view on that. So, if they had done what they were supposed to, they wouldn't have been in a situation, they would have been taken care of, they wouldn't have had to defend themselves, they wouldn't have had to fight, God would have been there for... I mean, isn't it amazing how it all just kind of domino effects and gets us here? And so this gets us to 9, 3 through 4. Even all the princes of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and those who were doing the king's business assisted the Jews because the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. Indeed, Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai became greater and greater. So it seems here that Mordecai was really good at his new job. So good that it, almost as if he allied the whole nation to the Jews, at least the people in charge, against these enemies, whoever it is. And I find it interesting. Do you not find it interesting? It doesn't name the group of people. It names Haman. It names his 10 sons. But the 750,000 or whatever it is, it doesn't. Does anybody see that? Does it say what, whether Egyptian or whether they're... Isn't that strange that it doesn't tell us? No one else thinks that's strange but me. I just find that odd. That are these Assyrians? Are these just random? Whoever these people are, unless it is the household of Haman, Haman's family name, are the ones that are doing this. But we see here that whatever the case was, people knew who they were. Mordecai had done a really good job, it seems like. Very good politician at this point. To the point that he had all the kings and governors and all the people of the provinces and everybody, he was mobilizing them on his side because they didn't want their... I guess they didn't want their head cut off. I don't know if Mordecai had threatened that, but whatever the case was, they were fearful. Maybe they were like, wait a second, the king's wife is a Jew, and that's Mordecai's uncle, and if I do something to the queen's family, the king might cut my head off, because that's what he did to Haman. You know, your brain starts working pretty good. When your life is on the line, and I'm just going to say this jokingly, but I bet when your life is on the line, even a drunk man sobers up and starts thinking clearly. because you start thinking really, really good then. And we know that people's lives are on the line because, you know, the king had already killed Haman. And so they start thinking pretty clearly here, it seems like. And they mobilize, and it looks like they begin to help them, which is maybe how they were able to overcome these people in such a very good way. Thus the Jews struck all the enemies with the sword, killing and destroying, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. And that did not... I should have used a different font there. And it says, at the citadel in Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. Okay? 500 men. And then Pershadathia, and I'm not going to say all those names because I can't. Verse 10, the 10 sons of Haman, Hamadath, the son of Hamadath the Jew, enemy, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. So there's a lot of stuff here. And we're going to dive. I think there's a lot of cool information right here. First of all, 500 in Susa. So Susa is where a lot of these events, and people were crazy about when it was announced. They didn't know why this was going on, and they were confused. So Susa is kind of this main centralized place here that we see it happen. So, but only 500, and I say that loosely, but only 500 were killed. Any killed would have been bad. But you're thinking, well, that's really not that many. But later we're going to find out that it was a lot more throughout the country. Secondly, here we see that the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, is mentioned here. Now, I don't know where these 10 sons, and when you read this, you seem here that the 10 sons were killed right then. Well, they're not. We're going to see later that they were captured and that the queen will ask for them to be hung. So when you read when I read through this, I was like, okay, so the 10 sons were killed. Well, not at this particular moment here. And then I found it interesting here that in Esther 3:1, every time it talks about, or five times it talks about Haman, it always mentions here the son of Hammedatha. And so it's what it says here about his sons, the sons of Haman, the sons of Hammedatha. But we go back to Agite. Remember when John was talking about Agite? Where does that go back? That goes back. Goes way back. And what they didn't do. Maybe by this time, and let me do some quick math in my head. Okay, so I'm going to teach you guys a little trick. Most of you probably already know it. So if you're going to do math, you got to know how to add and subtract, right? But you got to know a starting point. So King David was the best king, right? So King David ruled in 1010. He got two double tens, so 1010 BC. So he reigned for 40 years, which got him going in reverse order to 970. But Saul would have been 1040. Okay, so when does this book take place? That's right, about 478. All right, so do the math. 478 from 1040 would have been the beginning of Saul's reign. Is how many years? I can't do that real quick in my head. 700? 600? 560? 560. We got a mathematician back here. Got an accountant. He can do it. 560 years from when Saul didn't do what he was supposed to do, dude, we're seeing this mentioned right here. Just a little trick. I do all my dates with David because I can always remember 1010. So if you're going to go to Abraham, you're going to go the other way, or you're going to go forward, for some strange reason, somebody taught me that in school, so I always start with him. So the years here, 540 years. Was that right, Mike? I just forgot. 562 to be exact. Can you believe that people remembered or had hate for 562 years possibly? How long has our country been around? Does anybody know that off the top of your head? Not 562 years. It's about 200 and what? Huh? 254. 245, whatever he said. Not 250 years. 562 years. I mean, we're trying to change our history. People can't even hardly remember the history that we have. It's hard to even get, if you walk on the street, I used to watch jaywalking, and he would go around and ask people random questions about the 250 plus year or 240 year history, and they wouldn't even know. Like, you could just ask them random questions. 500 years. Isn't that crazy? Is that not... And I don't know how, if that nation had grown in 500 years, could have, I don't know, that they had grown and maybe they were now part of this 127 provinces and they had hated the Jews from that date and now they had grown. The text doesn't say, but what is interesting about Esther is it always goes back to tell us Hammedatha, who was an Agite. It just seems like it just keeps coming back to that for some strange reason, but just throwing that out there. Pretty crazy. And then it says here, they got the 10 sons, they killed the 500, but what did the Jews not do? They didn't take the plunder. Wait a second. Didn't Mordecai's decree say he could do that? Yes, it said, and we'll look at it in a minute. It said they could kill men, women, children, and they could take their plunder. Yet the Jews did not take their plunder. Why? I don't think I have a slide for that.
What's ironic to me is they weren't told not to, and yet King Saul was told not to and did. And we don't know that they were told either way, but they didn't.
You know, I just have a strange, it's just a theory. I got no text to back it up. I didn't read it in the book. It's just Gerald's theory. If they only killed the men, what would that leave? Okay, if you take all the plunder and you don't kill the women and children, what should you have probably went ahead and done? You should have waited and killed the women and children, because if they didn't have any financial means to take care of themselves, what kind of life is that going to be for those people? Yeah, he says it wasn't about revenge, it was about defense. It almost seemed as if they had compassion on the people, that the women and children, and they let them keep their stuff. That's just what I'm reading into it. That's Gerald Barr's, you know, verse 1, chapter 1, page 289 in my weird book, right? I can't come up with any other thing than that, because in this day and age, if you would have taken everything they had and you would have left them alive, I mean, you might as well have killed them, because it would have been a death sentence anyway. It seems even here that they had compassion and were defending themselves. It wasn't about revenge. It wasn't about anything other than them trying to keep their life and keep them ahead. So on that day, the number of those who killed in Citadel Susa was reported to the king. So they went, they told the king, hey, this is how many people died. The king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman at the citadel in Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your petition? It shall even be granted to you. And what is your further request? It shall be also done to you. So the queen is talking here, and the king is still amazing here. After a year, after they've been married, there's all different kinds of theories about their relationship. But I tell you what, one theory that's textual, that's consistent, is this one. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and modeled her queen instead of Vashti, and made her queen instead of Vashti. The king loved her. This was more than anything physical. He loved her. He loved her and told her, I'll give you half the kingdom, you know, 10, 11 months before this. I'll give you half the kingdom at the first banquet. I'll give you half the kingdom at the second banquet. She comes back and they kill Haman. 2-3 months later, she comes back to him. He grants her what she wants again. And then here, he's like, they've killed 500 and they've got the 10 sons. Is that enough, queen? Do I need to do more? What more do you want? I will do it. I will give you whatever you want. Why did he do that? My wife knows the answer.
Well, I don't know if I know the answer, but I was going to say, I think not only did he love her, but he saw God's faithfulness working through her. Back in verse 2, at the end when it says, and no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all the people, it reminds me when Israel was being led into the promised land and Rahab's talking to the spies and she tells them, we've heard of all these things your God has done and our hearts melted within us. We were so fearful of you. And I'm sure in Persia, the people that are natives there have seen a Jewish queen and a Jewish man like Mordecai rise to power. And even though God's name's not mentioned in that book, that's an example to those people that their God, you know, Yahweh is working through them. And I'm sure to the king, he sees all that this has happened. And he not only loves Esther, but he sees God's faithfulness working through her and for his people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of stuff we don't see out, you know, within the text here, and a lot of events that happened in 11 months. But I think it's amazing that he continues to be committed to her and committed to her happiness in granting her whatever it is that she wants when she wants it. And that's pretty amazing, in my mind. Pretty amazing here when he had so many other wives that weren't queens, and he had so many other things that were going on around him, and so many people who wanted stuff. Yet it seemed important to him to keep Queen Esther happy and to give her what she wanted. And I find that pretty amazing here in this overall story. So then said Esther, "If it pleases the king," I always love how she says, "If it pleases the king." I mean, the king says, "Esther, I don't care, whatever you want." But she's always very, isn't it funny? And I don't know her, never met her. You're probably thinking, why did he just say that? Of course he never does know her. No, nobody's here ever met her. But from the text, she seems to be a very humble lady, and at least in her approach to the king. "King, if it pleases you, if it pleases you, if it is something that you would like to do, this is what I would like to do, but I want to make sure you're happy about it. Let tomorrow also be granted to the Jews who are in Susa to do according to the edict of today, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on a gallows." Now, I've read two verses prior to this thinking that the sons were already dead, but they're not. And so she's asking that the 10 sons be hanged. And she's asking for another day of being able to defend themselves and have it extended. Not sure. We don't have any text to explain that. Maybe there was something else going on. Maybe there were more people out there that were planning to do more harm to them. It just doesn't tell us. But all we know is she asked not only for the 13th, but she asked for the 14th as well.
Something interesting that just occurred to me is kind of like what you just said. I never really thought of it as it says they're dead, and then all of a sudden she's saying she wants them hanged. Maybe, like I said, just occurred to me, maybe she wants their bodies hung up as a symbol. So they could have already been dead, and she wants them displayed. That's a possibility.
Yeah, very well possible. Like I said, I've read the text, two different verses. It seems like they're dead. And then she says, no, I want them hung. Maybe she wants them dead twice. I want to make sure they're dead. I want to make sure that we're not just faking their death here.
Well, to support what John just said, I first read this verse in a different translation, the NIV, and it took me back a second. It said, also let Haman's 10 sons be impaled upon poles.
Ah, that's an interesting translation.
Like, what? And then I read the other version. It says hanged by the gallows. I'm like, well, if it's impaled on poles, then yes, and they're already dead. She wants to make a statement.
Yeah, very good.
So to address that, something that I read when I was studying is the word hanging in Hebrew is more of a symbol of public execution. So the word gallows really, it could have been the gallows, but it was just a form of having the body displayed publicly. So in our vernacular, that's a gallows, but it could have been a pole or something like that. So
there you go. And that's working through this and studying through it. Great conversation here. Whatever the case here, she wants them up. She wants people to know about them. It seemed like reading this and the way that it put the provinces and it listed those a while ago that I didn't pronounce, that maybe these 10 sons were in some kind of authority in those. Because to get to where Haman had gotten, he must have had some kind of he had some kind of prominence to grasp to where he had. And odds are, if he had prominence, then what that means, they take care of their kids. So his kids probably had prominence too. And so they're taking them out. They're taking the sons out. They took him out. And so they're going to do that. And then she asked for another day. And that was interesting. We weren't able to accomplish the mission in one day. We need another 24 hours in order to be able to do that. And so that was pretty interesting there as well. What? Another day? And that's, you think that it would be over in the one day. So the king commanded that it should be done so, and an edict was issued in Susa, and Haman's 10 sons were hanged. Then the Jews were in Susa, assembled also the 14th day of the month Adar, and killed 300 men in Susa, but they did not lay their hands on the plunder. This is the second time it's going to tell us. They did not do this for financial gain. They did not touch the plunder. They're going to tell us a third time in the text that they did not touch the plunder. So the Holy Spirit in writing this is making a point. When you see something three times, they're making a point here that this was not about financial gain or revenge. They didn't take the plunder. Even though the edict said they could, and the edict said they could kill women and children, what'd they kill here? 300 men, and they did not take their plunder. And so I find that very interesting here, how the text puts that out there. So we're going to stop there because the bell's going to ring any second, and we'll pick up in verse 16, and we'll finish the chapter, and then we'll do chapter 10 as well. Thank you guys for your attention this morning.